I always feel like such an honor and a privilege to be able to do what I do. I'm delighted the Lord allows me to do this. And I get to speak on my specialty topic this evening too, which is a special joy. I do like talking about astronomy. That's what I got my PhD in, astrophysics. And it's a big universe. It's an amazing universe. And it's a universe that declares God's glory. And this is something that it's good for all of us to know a little bit about it. And of course, God calls some people like myself to, you know, really specialize in it. But we all ought to know a little bit about the basics of astronomy, because astronomy is one area where people have challenged the Bible. And they've said, no, you can't believe the Bible because we got this evidence from astronomy that proves, you know, Big Bang in billions of years. And you can't believe in biblical creation anymore, right? And I want to show you that, in fact, the evidence is consistent with what God has said in his word. I'm not going to prove that creation's true tonight. I have another presentation where I do that. I think it is possible. But I do want to show you that the evidence is consistent with what the Bible teaches about the universe and every aspect of creation when we look out there. And that's something that I think would be helpful for Christians to know. Not all Christians know that. Some people, you know, they'll be presented evidence and they'll deny the evidence. They'll say, no, you know, I don't believe in dinosaurs or something like that. There are people that would say that because they don't understand that there's a Christian way to look at the evidence. And that's the better approach, is to say, no, wait a minute, the evidence is out there and it makes sense in light of the Christian worldview. And that's what I want to talk about this evening in light of the universe. And there are a number of areas in which we're going to talk about how astronomy reveals creation. We're going to see that the glory of the Lord is revealed in the universe, that when the Bible touches on the universe and the fact that it declares God's glory, the Bible's exactly right. And when the Bible touches on the basics of astronomy, things you'd learn in any freshman-level astronomy class, the Bible got it exactly right. When the Bible touches on the age of the universe, that's a controversial issue, but it shouldn't be because the Bible got it right there too. And we're going to see that the evidence actually lines up with that when you understand the evidence. The Earth, the uniqueness of Earth in God's plan is something that really is confirmed by modern astronomy. And then I'm even going to touch on the starlight issue. I'm actually going to try to spend a significant amount of time on that issue. How did God get the light to the earth within the biblical time frame? Because that's one where the critics will say, well, we got you there. There's no way you can have the biblical time scale of a few thousand, 6,000 years, something like that, because those galaxies are so far away. Well, actually, there are known ways to do that. Actually, there's more than one way to do it. So we'll talk about that as well. So let's start with the glory of the Lord being revealed in creation. And I think there are a number of ways that the glory of the Lord is revealed in the universe. The Bible tells us in Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. I think all creation does that. It's interesting that the Bible singles out the heavens and the skies as declaring God's glory. Perhaps they do it in a unique way or maybe to a greater extent, I don't know. But in any case, the Bible uses that as the example, one example of something that declares God's glory. And there's at least two ways, or many more, but there are at least two that I'm going to talk about. The size and beauty of the universe are consistent with the mind of God, not chance. I think it's easier to believe in the Big Bang in billions of years if you don't know much about the universe, if you remain in ignorance. But the more you know about it, it gets very hard to deny that there's a mind behind the universe, not only its creation, but the fact that it is maintained by the mind of God and by his power. Every atom in the universe God is controlling, and none of them escapes his notice, and that's astonishing. Our minds can't comprehend that, but the mind of God controls all of that. And it's not a chance universe. It's one that's upheld and created by God. We're going to start with something relatively small, the moon. And it's only about the size of the United States. That is, if you were to put the United States at the same distance as the moon, it would cover about the same area, just to give you a feel for it. The moon is a delight. It's fun to look at it with a small telescope, even a backyard telescope. You can see all those dark features. Those are maria. They're kind of flat lands. It's all rock. They used to think marias were seas. They're not. They're rock. And just different types of rock, basalts and things like that. And then the lighter highlands that you see there. And sometimes I'll point the telescope at the moon and people will look at it. Wow, it's just amazing. Especially when it's in the first quarter phase and you can see the shadows of the craters and so on. Oh, it's stunning. And sometimes people will ask, well, can you see the flag that the astronauts planted on the moon? No, you can't see that. When you consider it's the size of the United States, you're not going to see a flag on it. But the interesting thing is we do have a spacecraft orbiting the moon, taking high-resolution images of its surface, and we now have the moon mapped in such detail that we can see where the astronauts landed. Isn't that amazing? In fact, I'm actually going to show this to you. In Mare Tranquillitatis, this is where the first moon landing was, the Apollo 11 landing site. That's an actual image of the Apollo landing site. You can see the lower section of the lunar module. Remember that spider-like looking structure? And they left the bottom portion to save fuel and just took off the top part. So it's still there, along with some other junk they left on the moon. We just pollute wherever we go. We leave little bits of junk everywhere. So you can see some scientific equipment they left there. And even and you see there's that dark line that comes over there and back? That's the footprints of the astronauts as they walked over to look at that crater and back. Pretty amazing, isn't it? 40-year-old footprints, and they're not going to go anywhere because there's no weather on the moon. So they're going to stay there for quite some time. There's nobody to go there and clean up the dust. So pretty amazing. But so the scale of the cosmos is just as amazing as its beauty. So we're going to take a look at some beautiful things in the universe that I think are consistent with the mind of God, a very creative God and a very powerful God who spoke all of this into existence by his word. So there's the moon in scale with the earth, just to give you a feel for it. And the moon is 240,000 miles away from the earth, so that's not the scale distance. But that's a large distance. And yet it's something you can sort of get your mind around, because some of you might have a car that has 240,000 miles on it, maybe. If it's like a Toyota or something, you might make it there. And so we can kind of have a feel for that, but that's about it. Once we get beyond the moon, you just lose all comprehension of distance, really, and size. We go out to Saturn, for example. There's Saturn at its true scale compared to the Earth and the moon. Now, again, it's fun to look at Saturn with a small telescope. It looks like this tiny little gem. You just want to stick it in your pocket, you know, and take it home with you. And people have looked at it, and first thing they'll do, they'll go, wow. And then they'll look at the telescope like, are you tricking me? Is that a slide? Is that really what it looks like? Yeah, that's really what it looks like. It's stunning, especially this time of year. It's right now, and it's in the sky where it's an optimal time of the year to look at it. But it's such a lesson in perspective, isn't it? Because you look at the telescope, and it's this tiny little thing, but in reality, it's 9 times the diameter of the Earth. And that's just the planet. The rings extend out even further. The rings are trillions of tiny little moonlets, ice and rock that orbit around Saturn's equator. Really stunning. Saturn's small potatoes compared to the sun. There's the sun, at its true scale. So the Earth is just a little blip at this point. There's the Earth right there. The sun is about 100 Earths across, and it's a giant ball of hydrogen gas. Hydrogen and helium, those are the two lightest elements, and we think the hydrogen's actually being fused into helium. We got good evidence for that. It's basically a nuclear bomb, a very stable nuclear bomb, extremely efficient. Yeah. And it's got enough fuel that it could last, well, longer than you'll have to worry about. Let's put it that way. The sun is a main sequence star, which basically main sequence means it obeys a particular rule that if you know the mass of the star, everything else is determined. And so you know the size, the color, the brightness, everything just based on its mass. And the sun obeys that rule, and most stars do, and a few don't. So it's a yellow main sequence. Yellow, the color of a star, by the way, is temperature related. The hotter the star is, the more bluish it is. The cooler it is, the more red it is. It's a little counterintuitive, but think of a Bunsen burner. The hot flame, you know, in the middle where it's hottest, it's blue, right? And where it's outside, it's cooler, it's red. And so the sun is a star. That itself is kind of amazing, and it was only a few hundred years ago that people really started realizing that. The sun is the same type of object. There's those little dots of light, just the sun is much, much closer. It's not even bigger than they are, it's just closer. It's bigger than some of them. The red dwarf stars, for example, are a little smaller than the sun, but not a whole lot smaller. And then there are some stars that are quite a bit larger than the sun, like Mintaka, which is a blue supergiant, one of the stars of Orion's belt that you can see in the winter sky. And you've got Canopus, which is larger than that, and that's visible low in the south around February, March. So it's a white supergiant. And I always like to bring that one up because white supergiants really shouldn't exist in the evolutionary scheme of things. They don't really know how to account for those. But in any case, they do exist. God made them. Antares, 600 suns across. Yeah, and the sun is 100 Earths across. You do the math, and it's really, really big. Stars sometimes come in clusters, and there's a couple different kinds of clusters, open clusters where you have a few hundred, maybe 1,000 stars, and then you have these globular star clusters where you have maybe 100,000 stars in a fairly compact region of space, maybe 50 light years across, something like that. A light year is 6 trillion miles. So it seems like that's an awfully big amount of space, but not compared to the rest of the universe. So, and these things are just stunning to look at. You can see these in a small telescope. If you have an 8-inch aperture or larger, you can actually see the individual stars in that cluster. You can even see these in binoculars, but you won't see the individual stars. It'll look like a little kind of glowing spot there, a little cotton ball in space. But really amazing. And there are a few hundred of these that orbit just outside our galaxy. And this, of course, these, I love looking at these, and it reminds me of the passage where it says that God calls them all by their names. God has, he numbers the stars and calls them all by their name. God's got a name for each one of those 100,000 or more stars. And we quickly run out of words, but God doesn't run out of words. Some of my favorite objects in the universe are nebulae. That's Latin. Nebula is the singular. It means cloud. And it's not a cloud of water vapor like in the Earth's atmosphere. It's a cloud of hydrogen and helium gas. That's the same stuff the sun's made of, the same stuff all stars are made of. But whereas stars are hydrogen and helium in a relatively compact area of space, a nebula is spread out over a very, very vast region of space. It's almost a perfect vacuum. There are just a few atoms in there, but they add up. A lot of atoms add up after a while. And if there are stars nearby, they'll cause that gas to glow, and you get the most beautiful and vivid shapes and colors. Artwork of God. And on a canvas that is absolutely enormous canvas, really amazing. And sometimes you get a star cluster in the nebula, so you get sort of two for the price of one there, and that's really stunning, I think. Now this, by the way, our solar system wouldn't even show up on this image, so we're already beyond, way beyond the scale of the solar system. Now some nebulae are relatively small. They're produced by the ejected gas of one star. And those are called planetary nebulae. It has nothing to do with planets. It's just some of them are round and look like an out-of-focus planet. That's all there is to it. But so here you have amazing artwork of God, and it's dynamic artwork of God because it's changing as that star ejects that gas. And so, you know, that's one of those little logical fallacies that people sometimes get trapped in. You know, did God make this art, or was it by the laws of nature? And the answer is both. God uses laws of nature to accomplish his will most of the time. He's not constrained by laws of nature. He can do what he wants. But laws of nature are not an alternative to God's power. Laws of nature are God's power. They're the way that God normally upholds the universe. And so this is an example of mediated design. It's very important to remember, because sometimes the evolutionists we'll try to get you on issues like that. You know, either God created all the organisms as we see them today, or there's been adaptation and natural selection. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. God made the original kinds, and God has enabled them to adapt to different environments. And God's sovereign over the universe. He can do that however he likes, right? And so that's an example of mediated design. I don't believe that there were poodles in the Garden of Eden, right? Because it was a paradise, and it was a perfect world. And so animals... Animals have changed a little bit, and God can do that, and he can do it however he likes. He can do it by internal to the animal, or he can do it by external pressures. He can do it however he likes, because he's God, and he's sovereign over all of creation. So I I've had Christians that have come up to me, oh, no, Dr. Lyle, you say that, you know, that gravity is what keeps the planets orbiting the sun, but hey, God upholds all things by the word of his power. It's God that holds the planets to the sun. And I'm thinking gravity is just the name we give to the way that God upholds his creation, you see. And so don't be fooled by a bifurcation fallacy where somebody says either this or that, when in fact God often uses natural processes to accomplish his will. And that's one spectacular example of that. In fact, all of these planetary nebulae were not, as far as we can tell, they weren't created this way. This is something that God has done throughout the course of time. And there's always a star in the middle that's ejecting that gas, and they're stunning to look at, really beautiful. One of my favorites is the Ring Nebula, because it's the first that I learned how to find. You can actually see this with a small telescope, if you know right where to look. And I've got a book that's got star charts in it that'll show you where to find this. It's a real easy one to find, because God put it right in between two stars that are naked eye stars. So you just go in between them, and there it is. And it's really neat. And, of course, most places you point a small telescope, you just see stars and stars and stars, and they're beautiful, but they're just stars. There's this one little spot where you will see a glowing smoke ring, and it is so strange to see this smoke ring hanging there. You're sort of expecting it to expand out like we've seen smoke rings do on Earth. And, of course, it is expanding. It's just really big, and it takes centuries for it to gain any considerable size. So there's one little spot where you will see a little cosmic Cheerio suspended on nothing. Really interesting. All these things that we've looked at, all these stars and planets and everything, are in a much larger structure, which we call a galaxy. And a galaxy looks something like that. What you're seeing there is a collection of 100 billion or more stars, 100 billion or more stars. Amazing. And there's so many, they tend to blend together. It's only by zooming in that you can see individual stars. In fact, in the early 1900s, a lot of people thought that these were nebulae. And you'll see that in some of the older textbooks. They call them spiral nebulae. And they don't call them that anymore. They thought they were close and small, but in fact, they're island universes. They're like, we live in a galaxy like that, and then there are other galaxies like that. They used to think before 1900, they used to think ours was the only one. And then we find, oh, we're one among 100 billion or so galaxies out in the universe. All kinds of tremendous galaxies out in space. Galaxies of tremendous beauty. Galaxies of tremendous ugliness. Yeah. There are galaxies with large mysterious arrows next to them. How about that? You'll see that in all the textbooks. I've never seen one in my telescope, though, for some reason. Stars with rings of, or galaxies with rings of stars surrounding, that's kind of interesting. They're galaxies that look like flying saucers. That's a real galaxy. Yeah, they call that the Sombrero Galaxy, and you can see why. It's got that dark dust lane that cuts in front there. I always like this one. And again, this one you can see in a small telescope, part of the Virgo supercluster, visible in the spring night sky, kind of a southerly galaxy. And you can see that dark dust lane right there. It's cosmic. It is so strange to see that thing. And I really like this one because this one's kind of famous. And I'd seen it growing up, you know, in a kid. I'd seen it in textbooks and things. And in fact, there was the old sci-fi show Outer Limits. And at the end, they'd show these different galaxies. And that was one of the ones that they showed. And when I got to see with my own eyes, how about that? It's real. It's really there. Pretty neat. There are galaxies in the process of collision. And, of course, people think, well, is that a problem? You know, galaxies colliding? And, well, not for us, right? Because we're here and they're there. But even if we were there, it wouldn't be a problem because the distance between stars is enormous compared to the size of stars. It's enormous. And so all the stars would just pass right by each other. The chances of any two colliding are remote. And so those galaxies will get distorted, but it won't hurt them at all. Galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies. Everything you see there, it's not a star, it's a galaxy. With perhaps 100 billion stars each. And so you're actually seeing a cluster of galaxies. We know that galaxies come in clusters. They're not randomly just thrown about in space. They form like a cobweb-type structure out in space. It's one of the things we're studying now. One of the research projects I'm working on is seeing what the structure of these galaxies looks like in space. It's a really fascinating project. And again, we got even deeper into space. You see stars upon stars, actually galaxies upon galaxies, each one of those having hundreds of billions of stars in them. Each one of those is a galaxy. That small little speck you see there, that's a galaxy. And those ones right there, at tremendous distance, this is pretty close to the limit of current technology in terms of being able to go out as far as we can go into space. How about that? And that's what we see in just one little section of the universe. And the Bible indicates that that was all spoken into existence by the Word of God. How about that? All that spoken into existence. And, of course, according to Scripture, this was all made in 6 days. In fact, most of what we're seeing here was made in one day, day four. Because if you read the Genesis account, God takes 5 of the 6 creation days working the earth, making it right for life. He takes one day and makes everything else. Like, you know what would go really good with an earth? How about 100 billion galaxies? Why not throw that in, right? And I love the way the Bible talks about the creation of these hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars each. It's summed up in this little phrase, "He made the stars also." That's how it's described in Genesis. And that gives you just a little perspective on how easy it was for God, a God who is all-powerful, to speak into existence 100 billion galaxies. Think of the power involved. Think of the power that our sun puts out, which is one relatively mediocre star. And every second, it produces more energy, it releases more energy than a billion major cities could use in a year. Every second, the sun's doing that. And it's a mediocre star. There are other stars that are doing that, hundreds of billions in our galaxy. Think of the power of all that, spoken into existence by the Word of God. And how do we know that God made all of that? Because He's revealed Himself to us. Romans 1 teaches that, right? God has revealed Himself to us. First of all, He's revealed Himself in His Word, and His Word tells us categorically that He made all of these things. And of course, some things have happened since. We've seen new nebula forming and so on. That's mediated design, of course. But we know that God made all these things, and because God has revealed Himself to us, He's hardwired us in such a way. It's not that, you know, you think, well, scientists are smart and they've realized that certain things require a creator and so on. And, well, you know, it's true that certain things require a creator, but that's not why we know God exists. It's not because we're smart and we figured it out. It's because God hardwired us to know that He exists. He's built that into us. It's revealed in our conscience. It's revealed in such a way that when we look into creation, it's not that we reason through things and say, well, you know, there's an example of irreducible complexity. I mean, that's true that reveals God, to be sure. But we immediately know that God created when we look into the universe because God's hardwired us to know that. Isn't that interesting? It's certainly true that machines require a creator, but there, as far as I know, there are no machines in space, except for the very few that human beings have put in there. The Earth is the only place where God placed biological machines that he made, and then we've been able to make other machines. But the universe is still God's handiwork. And it's the fact that it exists and obeys laws of nature and so on is consistent with the mind of God. It's not consistent with a chance, big bang, billions of years of evolution and so on. Not at all. What about the basics of astronomy? Things that you'd learn in any freshman-level astronomy class? Well, you know, the Bible is right about those. Even when secular experts of the day have disagreed, the Bible has always turned out to be right. Isn't that interesting? And let me give you some examples of these things. Things that were not always believed, but today you'll find them in every astronomy textbook that I know of anyway. The spherical nature of the Earth. The Bible actually talks about the Earth being circular around. And in Isaiah 40:22, the circle of the Earth is used. You might think, well, that might be a flat circle. But I don't think that Job 26:10 could be interpreted that way, because it says that God inscribes a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. And that boundary is what astronomers call the terminator, where light stops or terminates, right? And the only way it can be a circle is if the Earth is spherical. That's the only way that it would always be a circle. And it's on the waters, because the Earth's surface is mostly water. And so it's a very clear description, I think, of the spherical nature of our world. It's funny, because people will say, well, you believe in biblical creation, you're one of those young Earth creationists. It's like believing in a flat Earth. I'm thinking, well, the Bible says the world's round. So if you'd read it, you'd know God does know what he's talking about when it comes to science. He did create a universe. He knows science better than any of us, certainly. But the interesting thing is most secular textbooks will credit Pythagoras with being the first person to come up with the idea that the Earth might be round, and Aristotle is generally considered the first to prove that the world's round from shadows of eclipses and masts of ships being seen before the ship's seen as it sails in and so on. But as far as I can tell, the Bible is discussing this issue correctly before the secularists of the day. Isn't that interesting? They really shouldn't be credited with being the first to have that insight. Especially with Job. Job, we think, is the oldest book of the Bible to have been completed anyway. And it's 2000 BC. It's long before the Greeks figured this out. Almost as if the Hebrews had some divine insight into that kind of issue. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? By the way, the idea that Christopher Columbus was the first to come up with the idea that the world was round is a myth. People already knew the world was round at the time of Columbus. At least educated people did. He just thought it'd be faster to go that way, which it turns out it's not. So there you go. Those little myths get propagated sometimes. Earth is suspended in space. The Bible poetically describes God hanging the earth upon nothing. Isn't that right? And that's a wonderful description of the nature of gravity, a poetic description of the nature of gravity. And again, Job, written about 2000 BC. But the early Greek scientists taught that the earth was a flat disk and floated in water. Isn't that interesting? And wouldn't that make more sense? Because, I mean, we've seen things float in water. But to hang something on nothing, you can't do that. That's impossible. Except we now have pictures that confirm that the Bible's exactly right about that. The Greeks were what we call wrong. The expansion of the universe. The Bible teaches that the universe has been stretched out, or perhaps is being stretched out or expanded like a curtain, spread out as a tent to dwell in. And that's kind of hard to fathom, isn't it? The idea that everything's sort of being stretched out. It's as if the universe is being, it's getting bigger. And how does that mean, and how does that happen, and why is God doing that? I don't know the details, but the Bible tells me it happens, and so it's happened. But again, that's written in Isaiah, 700 BC. It wasn't until the 1920s that the secular scientists caught up with this truth and realized from observations of redshifts of galaxies that the universe is getting bigger. It's as if all galaxies are sort of moving away from all other galaxies, not just from our position, but from each other as well. It's as if everything's just getting bigger. Not that the individual stars are getting bigger, but the distance between galaxies is increasing, you see. And we call that the Hubble law, and it's something that's well confirmed today. It's counterintuitive, though, isn't it? Because you go outside tonight, and you look up, and you see the night sky for the first time in a long time. That'll be kind of nice. and then you go out tomorrow night, and you look up, and you see it looks about the same size, doesn't it? It doesn't look like the universe is getting bigger. But it is, and we can now confirm that scientifically. Now, some people have said, well, does this mean a big bang then? Because if everything's moving away from everything else, does that mean that the universe, you know, exploded into existence 13 billion years ago, right? Because if you run it all back, it goes back to a point and so on. Well, just because something's getting bigger doesn't mean it exploded into existence 13 billion years ago, right? Some of you are getting bigger. That doesn't mean you exploded into existence billions of years ago. Not at all. Not at all. fallacy of affirming the consequent. I won't get into the logic of that, but anyway. No, it just means the universe is getting bigger. Apparently God made it with some size and he stretched it out since then. There's no reason to think that it started at a point. That's an unwarranted extrapolation. There's no reason to think that logically. And people have said, well, does this at least confirm? Does it give credence to the Big Bang? Didn't the Big Bang predict that the universe should be expanding? And lo and behold, there it is. Doesn't that at least count as confirming evidence? The answer is no, because the expansion was discovered, and then the Big Bang was invented to explain it, you see. It's not a prediction of the Big Bang. The expansion of the universe was discovered in the late 1920s. The Big Bang, the idea that the universe came from a point, 1931. And Lemaître, the guy that came up with the Big Bang, he knew that the universe was expanding, and that was sort of a materialistic explanation for that expansion. So it doesn't count as a prediction if it comes afterwards. Okay, conservation of energy and mass. This is a little more abstract, but I do believe the Bible teaches the amount of stuff in the universe is constant. The amount of stuff, the amount of mass, or the amount of energy. Einstein tells us energy and mass are basically the same thing measured in two different ways. The Bible tells us all things were made by him, that is, by God. And on the seventh day, God ended his work of creation. And so that tells me nothing new is going to pop into existence, right? Because it would either mean God's still creating, which cannot be because God ended his work by the seventh day, or it would mean that something can come into existence apart from God, which cannot be because all things were made by him, right? And so in general, we'd expect no new material is going to come into existence. Furthermore, God upholds what he's made. God upholds all things by the word of his power. In him or by him, all things consist or hold together. And so God maintains that which he's made. He allows the form to change, but the amount of stuff, the quantity doesn't change. And those two principles together are what we call the conservation of energy or the conservation of mass. And it's tough to pin down when these were discovered, but usually James Joule is credited with the discovery of conservation of energy, and he's 1800s. So again, the Bible's writing about these principles, not using the modern jargon, of course. God's not going to do that. He didn't write the Bible just for physicists. He wrote it for us all to understand. But the principle's there. Isn't that interesting? Long before the secularists came and caught up to that truth. By the way, does this preclude a creative miracle? Could God create something new if he wanted to? Of course. That's not a problem. God can do a miracle. These are generalizations, right? God in general has ended his work of creation. Uncountable numbers of stars. The Bible describes Abraham's descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. A figure of speech indicating an uncountable number. Another passage says it that way. It says, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Human beings can't count the number of stars out there. We can estimate them. We estimate 100 billion stars in our galaxy. That's a pretty good representation of a humanly uncountable number, isn't it? Again, it might have been a little bit hard to believe when it was first written that it was a good analogy, because the number of stars you can see in the night sky is a few thousand, somewhere between 3,000 or, if you have a really good vision, 10,000 stars in the night sky, which is a big number, but it's countable. And then telescopes were invented, and we pointed them out, and that Milky Way that looks like a cloudy band, oh, that's hundreds of billions of stars, and that you can't count. So it's an example of an analogy that was good when it was written, and modern science confirms that the Bible is true, and it's even more insightful. It's a more insightful analogy than the people who originally inscribed it probably realized. It's kind of interesting how God has revealed himself progressively that way. So we have an advantage today. We have more revelation from God, actually, than they did. God's always given enough revelation, to be sure, but we have more today. We have that advantage. So again, it's a wonderful illustration of a biblical truth. By the way, there was a time when people believed that there were only 1,024 stars. Isn't that interesting? And it wasn't that long ago, but just a few hundred years ago, there was a large number of scientists who thought there were 1,024 stars because Ptolemy, a Greek astronomer, had cataloged 1,024 stars. And Ptolemy never claimed that his list was exhaustive, but there was a philosophy at the time that everything worth knowing was known to the Greeks. And so if Ptolemy hadn't cataloged it, it wasn't there. Despite the fact you can see more stars than that. So it's a great example of how having a faulty philosophy can really affect in a negative way your interpretation of the evidence. Conversely, having a correct philosophy, a philosophy that's after Christ, will improve your understanding of the evidence. We're still finite, we're still fallible, we're going to mess up from time to time. But why not start with truth, right? Do you get the point? That's what I want to know. Do you get the point? Have we learned the lesson of history? Have we learned that in the past, whenever the experts of the day have disagreed with the Bible has always turned out to be right? Have we learned that history lesson? Some of us have. A lot of us haven't, right? I mean, there's a lot of people today that would say, oh, yes, but the Bible got this wrong, and we know today. That's the attitude of most secular scientists, and they haven't learned the lesson of history. Whenever the experts disagreed, the Bible, it was not the thing that needed to be modified. It was the secular view of the day that needed to be modified. And I realize we have to use the proper hermeneutic and everything to make sure we understand what the text is saying, because people sometimes can go wrong in that area too. I understand that. But when you understand the text, when you use proper biblical hermeneutics and the Bible's clearly teaching something, it's always been right. And those people who disagreed with it today, they have egg on their face. They were wrong. And there are scientists today who have not learned that lesson. And one area where they haven't learned that lesson deals with the age of the universe. Because let's face it, most secularists teach the universe is billions of years old. 13.8 billion years is the latest number. It changes every few years by a few hundred million or so. When they learned that some of the facts were that they had before were wrong. But in any case, the evidence is actually very consistent with Scripture. Yeah. The Bible's right when it talks about the age of the universe being a few thousand years. I need to point out the universe, that the Bible does teach a young universe. The Bible tells us God created in 6 days. It's clear from context. Those are ordinary, approximately 24-hour days, because each one is bounded by an evening and a morning, and they're in a numbered list and so on. In fact, our work week is based on the creation week, according to Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. And the stars, of course, the luminous objects in the universe, which would include planets, galaxies, which are made of stars, made on day 4. And then we know from those genealogies that you love to read before you go to bed, and so-and-so begets so-and-so, and they beget so-and-so. You add up the ages of those, and you find it's a few thousand years ago that God created human beings. Stars are just 2 days older than human beings, the first human beings. There's evidence that's consistent with that. Let me show you some of these. The excess internal heat of the giant planets. Jupiter gives off twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. Think about that. So it's getting one unit, and it gives away two. Now, it can't do that forever, right? It's not the federal government. It can't just keep spending more away than it's taking in. So, I mean, it's eventually going to run out of energy, right? And it turns out that if you do the math, it should be an icicle by now. It shouldn't have that internal heat if it were billions of years old. Now, in a few thousand years, it's not a problem because it just hasn't had time to lose heat. It's kind of like a potato that you take out of the microwave. It's nice and warm, and you can feel the heat radiating off into space. It doesn't do that forever, right? It cools off relatively quickly. Now, Jupiter is a much bigger potato, and so it can do that for a lot longer, but it can't do it for billions of years. The problem's even worse for Neptune, which is about four times the sun. Jupiter's about 10, 11 Earths across, something like that. Neptune's about four Earths across. And so it's a smaller planet, and it gives off 2.6 to 2.7 times as much energy as it receives from the sun. Why is it so warm? And I want to suggest it's because it's about 6,000 years old and hasn't had time to cool off yet. If it really were billions of years old, it would be an icicle by now. The Earth's magnetic field. You might know that the Earth has a magnetic field that surrounds us. It's caused by electrical current in the core, and that any electrical current always creates a magnetic field, and that actually protects us from radiation from the sun and other cosmic radiation. It acts kind of like a shield around the Earth, so it's very good we have that magnetic field. Some of the other planets do as well. And magnetic fields, though, because they're caused by electrical current encounters resistance and decays with time. We've been able to measure that with the Earth's magnetic field. We know it's decaying with time. And you run it backwards, it would have been stronger in the past. Now, we think during the flood year, there's some complicated flood models out there. We think due to the plate tectonics, the Earth's magnetic field would have been disrupted. But that actually just causes it to drain even faster. It just means the poles would reverse back and forth because it disrupts those currents. But aside from that, it's just been decaying as far as we can tell since creation. And today, it's just decaying. It's a simple exponential decay as far as we can tell. All our measurements are confirming of that. And we've been able to measure it for at least 150 years, something like that. Almost two centuries, we've been able to measure the decay of Earth's magnetic field. We'd expect it to decay. You run the movie backwards. I've done the math. If you go back 60,000 years, the Earth's magnetic field would be stronger than a neutron star, which would be enough to rip the atoms of your body apart. So you wouldn't want that. It can't be that old, right? And that's not even 1 million years. That's 60,000 years. It's a really tight constraint because it's an exponential decay. You go back, it gets really quick, really, really powerful, really quick. The problem's even worse for some of the other planets. Jupiter has a whopping big magnetic field, be larger than the sun if you could see it. It's enormous, powerful. Why is it so strong if the planet's really billions of years old? I want to suggest it's because the planet's not billions of years old. Magnetic fields decay with time. They just do. We'd expect that due to the electrical resistance. The planets Uranus and Neptune, they have magnetic fields. And this was a surprise to the secularists who were expecting that the planet Uranus really shouldn't have much of a magnetic field at all. But it does have one. In fact, the magnetic field is strong enough that you can have aurora. You know, the northern lights, those are caused by Earth's magnetic field being disturbed by particles from space. You can actually have northern lights on the planet Uranus, and there they are. That's an actual image there. And, of course, it's much further away from the sun, so it's got to have a strong magnetic field to have that. And the interesting thing, too, about the planet Uranus is the magnetic field is not aligned with the rotation axis. First of all, the rotation axis is sideways. So the planet Uranus rolls around the sun, kind of like that. And then the magnetic field stuck in at an angle, so it would just, it would wobble like that as the planet rotates. It's really messed up on a number of levels. And I suspect God did it that way just to confuse the secularists, because there's no secular explanation for why it should be that way, really. And in fact, my friend and colleague, who's a creation physicist, Dr. Russ Humphreys, predicted the magnetic field of Uranus and Neptune based on their biblical age of 6,000 years. He's got a model for how God might have started the initial strength of the magnetic fields. And he says, based on 6,000 years, it should be decayed down to this level today. And he predicted that before the Voyager 2 spacecraft flew by and measured the magnetic fields. And Dr. Humphreys was right on. The secularists were way off, because they were assuming billions of years, whereas he correctly assumed 6,000 years. And you see how real science starts from the Bible? If you want to get the right answer, you better start with truth, right? Anyway, interesting stuff. The recession of the moon. The moon's actually moving away from the Earth due to tidal forces. So you might know that, you know, the moon causes tidal bulges on the Earth, pulls on the Earth's oceans, and you get a tidal bulge there. You actually get one over here, too. And people ask, how do you get a bulge on the backside? Well, it's pulling the Earth away from that ocean, you see. That's the way to think about it. So you get two tidal bulges. But the Earth rotates faster than the moon orbits, and so the tidal bulges are always ahead of the moon, pulling forward on it. And when you pull forward on something in orbit, it moves out. It's a little counterintuitive, but if you've ever played with a gyroscope, you know that, you know, when you push on it this way and it goes that way, it's a little bit strange when things are spinning the way it acts. But if the astronauts, if they want to go into a higher orbit, they thrust forward. That gives the shuttle energy, and it moves them up. And so it's the same way with the moon. The moon's just doing this constantly. It's moving about an inch and a half a year, so it's not much. But we can measure it, because we left reflectors on the moon when we sent the astronauts there. They left some reflectors, and we can bounce lasers off them and get the distance of the moon very, very precisely. And we'd expect it to be moving away just based on the physics. You run the math backwards, the Earth and moon would have been touching at 1.4 to 1.5 billion years ago, which may sound like a lot, but keep in mind, they're supposed to be 4.5 billion years old. Now, last time I checked, 1.4 is less than 4.5, so I think that's a problem. It's not a problem if they're 6,000 years old, because the moon would have been 730 feet closer to the Earth. Not a big deal. By the way, you have to do the math. The math's a little bit complicated here. You can't just do a linear extrapolation, because as the moon gets closer, running the movie backwards, as the moon gets closer to the Earth, the tidal bulges get bigger, it moves faster, it gets bigger, and so on. So you have to do calculus to do it right. But you don't get 4.5 billion years. It's wildly inconsistent with the secular timescale. Comets are made up of icy material that can't last billions of years, because comets are supposed to have formed when the solar system did, and they're icy objects. They spend most of their time far away from the sun, but then they come in and they get whiplashed back out like that, and have a very elliptical paths. And every time a comet made up of ice gets close to the sun, that can't be good, right? Ice close to the sun. What it does is it vaporizes that ice, and that's what forms a comet's tail. That's material being blasted away from the comet. Every time you see a comet, it's getting smaller. It's losing mass. So all comets were more spectacular in the past than they are today. They're always losing mass. They're getting smaller. They can't do that for more than about 100,000 years. And my secular colleagues, they won't even dispute that. They say, well, there must be this comet generator that makes new ones, which they call an Oort cloud. But there's no evidence for an Oort cloud. It's just a rescuing device that the evolutionists have invoked. We have spiral galaxies. These, not all galaxies are spirals, but a lot of them are. And they have these beautiful spiral arms made up of hundreds of billions of stars. The interesting thing is they rotate differentially, which means the inner portions rotate quicker than the outer portions in terms of their angular velocity. And what that means is, you think about it, the inner portions are going like that and the outer portions are going like that. It's got to be twisting itself up, right? It's got to be, that spiral structure has to twist tighter and tighter. And I actually did some computer simulations to see what galaxies would look like if they were really 10 billion years old. And the answer is they don't look anything like that. They look like a uniform disk. The spiral structure is gone in well less than 1 billion years. The spiral structure is totally gone. It's twisted beyond recognition. And yet there's not one spiral galaxy that we see anywhere in the universe that's twisted beyond recognition, not one. They're supposed to be 10 billion years old. They would be twisted beyond recognition if they were even one-tenth that age. And so I think it's consistent with biblical creation. You might also notice the bluish tinge to these spiral arms. The spiral arms contain a higher proportion of blue stars than the core does. And blue stars are an evidence of the youth of the universe because blue stars are the most luminous stars. They expend energy. They give off a lot more energy than the sun does, and they can't do that, therefore, for very long. Now, it's true that the blue stars have the most mass. They have the biggest. They're kind of like an SUV. They have a big gas tank, but they get very poor gas mileage, and so they can't go very far in time. And so blue stars can't last anywhere close to hundreds of millions of years, and yet we find them everywhere in the universe. And, again, my secular colleagues would say, well, new ones must form. Guess how many new stars we've seen form? None. None. No one's ever seen a star form. We've seen them blow up sometimes, but they never form. Interesting. So I suggest that's an evidence for the youth of the universe. What about the uniqueness of the Earth? In the secular view, Earth's just another world, right? Pale blue dot where the chemicals happen to be right for life to evolve. But our world really is special. It's unique. In fact, it's formed for life. God formed it to be inhabited. And as a result of that, the Earth has special properties that enable life to exist here. Space is kind of hostile to life. You wouldn't do so well in space. I actually have a friend who's an astronaut, and he was telling me about some of his experiences in space and some of the problems physically, because our bodies are not designed for zero G and everything like that. And of course, he's just orbiting around the Earth, where you're still inside Earth's protective magnetic field and so on. If you were in deep space, all kinds of things that can kill you in deep space, just cosmic radiation and so on. It's really hostile to life. Earth is this beautiful little oasis where it's just designed for life. And in fact, to show its special significance, God made it first among the objects of the universe. It's kind of interesting. All the other luminous objects in the universe, the sun, the moon, the stars, and the Hebrew word kokhav for star would include planets as well. So all the other planets are made on day four. Earth's made on day one. God spends five of the six creation days working on that little blue dot. And the one day, day four, he makes everything else. So Earth is really special. It really is. Earth's neighbors, they're beautiful. They exhibit a type of design, but it's not the same as the Earth. One of the astronauts who actually walked on the moon's surface referred to it as a magnificent desolation. I think that's a wonderful description of the moon's surface. It does have a beauty to it, to be sure, but it's not designed for life. The surface temperature between the day side and the night side is hundreds of degrees. There's no air on the moon, so that might be a problem. There's no water on the moon, so that would be a problem. Again, lots of things that could kill you on the moon. And so, in fact, the astronauts had to take a little bit of Earth with them when they went, right? That's what a spacesuit is. You're taking a little bit of Earth and oxygen and so on with you and atmospheric pressure. And they had to land at the right time of day so the temperature was about right and so on. What about Earth's neighbors? You got Venus, a little closer to the sun. Mars, a little bit further away from the sun. What, could they have life on their surface? A lot of science has been devoted to trying to find life on Mars. They haven't found any. Before we knew a lot about Venus, there was a lot of speculation about life on Venus. It's a little closer to the sun, maybe be the tropical paradise, all kinds of exotic life forms growing on its surface. And scientists were free to speculate because Venus is permanently enshrouded in thick clouds. You would never see the sun on Venus. It's been kind of like here the last month, really. But anyway, you would never see the sun on Venus. And so they were free to speculate, unfettered by inconvenient data. But we now have the technology to penetrate those clouds using radar, and we know that the surface of Venus, actually we've landed spacecraft there even, the surface temperature is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, so it is not a nice place to visit. And those clouds that you see there are made up of sulfuric acid type compounds, so there's just lots of wonderful ways to die on Venus. It's not a place you'd want to visit, really. And even Mars is not. Mars is a little better, but even it, you'd need atmosphere because its atmosphere is carbon dioxide in levels that would be toxic to us. There's not free oxygen in the atmosphere. It doesn't have the protective magnetic field that Earth does. Again, it's just not. It's not right for life. And of course, the temperature's too cold on Mars. So it's kind of like these two planets too hot, that one too cold, that one just right. It's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? That's what we'd expect. And, of course, there's this Fermi paradox. Where are all these aliens? Because the secularists expect to find aliens out in space, and we haven't found them. And I think that's because God didn't make aliens out in space. I realize God can do what he wants, and, you know, that's fine if he wanted to make them. But at the same time, when we read all these scriptures about how the earth's formed to be inhabited and so on, and God giving us dominion over the animals on the earth, but, we don't have that type of dominion in space. The heavens are the Lord's, even the high heavens. Well, I would expect that there's probably not life in space. Of course, if you got intelligent life in space, you got some theological issues you're going to have to think through, right? Because if you got Vulcans and Klingons out there, they can't be saved because they're not, think about that. They're not related to Jesus Christ. We are. It's because we're a blood relative of Christ that he can be our kinsman redeemer. Yes? His blood on the cross counts for ours. We're all of one blood. But Lieutenant Worf is out of luck because he's not related to Jesus, so he can't be saved. That's a problem. And you say, well, maybe Jesus went to the Klingon homeworld and died for them too. No, because the Bible says he died once for all. He was raised incorruptible, right? So he's not going to die again. Not at all. They say, maybe the Klingons never sinned. Well, then they're feeling the effects of sin due to Adam's sin, which all creation groans under that bondage of corruption. So again, it's there's some theological issues you're going to have to think through. But I want to suggest that, as entertaining as I find Star Trek, that the real universe, the biblical universe, isn't that way. At least that's what I expect. What about starlight? I want to spend a little the remaining time on this, actually. Distant starlight's not really a problem in a young universe. The problem, as it's been stated, is that light from distant galaxies is supposed to take billions of years to get from there to here. Light's very, very fast, 186,000 miles in 1 second. That's how fast it travels. But these galaxies are so far away that even at that speed, you'd think it would take billions of years for the light to get from there to here. But the point is, we see these galaxies, and therefore the light has gone from there to here because we see them, right? And so that seems pretty reasonable. And before I give you what I think the answer to this is, I have to point out there are some solutions that really don't work. And I mention this because if I don't, people will come up and say, have you thought of this? And yes, we've thought of that. There's a reason it doesn't work. The idea that maybe the distances aren't real. Maybe the galaxies are actually very close. No, there's good. And I don't have time to go into these in detail. I'm sorry. I have written about these. And you can take a look at some of our literature. But the distances are real. And it glorifies God that the universe is as big as it is. And there's good science that confirms that. The speed of light was much faster in the past, maybe, and it just slowed down to current rates. I don't think that's true. It was a good thing to check. I'm glad that somebody thought of that and looked into it, because sometimes evolutionists assume that rates are constant, and they're not. And so that was a good thing to check. But I think in this case, there's good evidence that the speed of light has always been about what it is today. In fact, even the nature of matter depends on the speed of light, interestingly. So, or the light was created in transit. Maybe God made the beams already on their way. And there's some aspects of that I like, because I do believe that God created a mature universe in the sense that it was functional from the beginning. But I don't think he made beams of light already on their way, because that implies that God created fictional images and movies of things that never happened. For example, supernova 1987A. In the year 1987, we saw this little star right here blow itself to bits. Very sad. But he left a lovely nebula as a result. That's basically expanding star guts. That's the star expanding out in space there. And that's kind of what it looks like today. So now the problem here is this is I think it's 179,000 light years away. 179,000 light years away, which means in secular thinking, it happened 179,000 years ago, and the light finally reached Earth in 1987. If you say, no, I think the way to get around that is God made the beam of light already on its way with images of that explosion. And what that means is that this star right here never actually existed. It's just an image that God placed in a beam of light that extends about 6,000 light years out. And then this image of this explosion, which never happened, finally reached the Earth in 1987. It requires God to make fictional images. And it's not that God lacks the power to do that. We know he can do what he wants in terms of power. But I think it's inconsistent with his nature to do that. So I don't think that's true. I don't think that God would make fictional images for us to see. He made our eyes and ears after all, and so I think they're basically reliable. And by the way, if you think that your eyes are not basically reliable, then how do you know I'm here right now, right? I mean, if God's going to make fictional light beams, you can't be sure of anything. You can't be sure that I'm here right now, because he could be making the beam of light 1 inch away from your eye. You say, well, we hear you too. No problem. God's making the sound 1 inch away from your ear. You could be a brain in a jar, and God's just feeding you all these different inputs, right? And that's not the Christian worldview. We live in a real universe. We understand that. So by way of illustration of why I don't think those are the best answer, one that's a little more plausible, but I don't think it's the final right answer, and again, my friend Dr. Humphreys pointed out that Einstein showed that time can flow at different rates in different environments, which it certainly can. And so he's got a model that, and there's some others too, that have proposed that maybe time flows slower on the Earth than it does in space, or at least it has in the past. I haven't seen a solution, though, that actually works mathematically in terms of actually getting the light here in 6,000 years. It's a neat idea, and they continue to work on it. They might get a version that works. That's fine. I think there's a better answer. This is what I think the answer is. You can take this for what it's worth. And it's a little bit of a brain scratcher, so I'm going to ask you to think here a little bit. But, you know, truth sometimes is not easy. A friend of mine used to say, well, you know, Jason, you need to make this easier to understand for people. And I'm thinking, well, if it's the answer, then it is what it is. I mean, quantum mechanics apparently is true, and it's not easy to explain. So some things just are that way. The Trinity might be hard for us to grasp, but it's true because we know it's scriptural. Anyway, the solution may involve the one-way speed of light. When we talk about the speed of light being abbreviated by the lowercase c, that's always a round-trip speed, being 186,000 miles per second. That's a round-trip time average speed. And what that means is, it's the speed of light as it comes back to its destination. Basically, let's do a little thought experiment here. What I'm going to do is we're going to measure the speed of light. I'm going to build a really long hallway, 186,000 miles long, and we'll pretend we have government funding so we can do it that way. And okay, and I'm going to stand at one end of it with my flashlight, and I'm going to have a mirror at the other end of it, or maybe I've got a buddy over there with another flashlight. Either way. And right when my clock strikes noon, I'm going to send out the light pulse. It's going to hit the mirror and come back. Or maybe it's going to hit my buddy, and he's going to see it, and then he's going to send the pulse back. Either way. And then I'm going to watch for the signal. And as soon as I see the reflection, I'm going to look at the clock. And it turns out if we would do this experiment, 2 seconds would elapse. It takes 2 seconds for light to travel out to that mirror and back. And so that's 186,000 that it has to travel twice, divided by 2 seconds. That's the average speed of 186,282 miles per second. That's how the speed of light is measured. But that's a round-trip speed. Most people assume that the light took 1 second to go out and 1 second to come back, especially since I've illustrated it that way. So I've cheated a little bit. But we don't really know that, right? I mean, I'm standing over here. All I know is it takes 2 seconds for it to make the total trip. For example, hypothetically, it could take no time at all to get out there. It might take zero time to get out there and take all of the 2 seconds to get back. Now, how would I know the difference? You see what I'm saying? Because I'm standing here, all I know is when I start it, and I know when I see the reflection. That's all I know. I don't really know when it hits the mirror. Or it could be the reverse. It could be that the light takes all of its 2 seconds to go out and it takes no time at all to come back. Isn't that interesting? I mean, it could be that way. And you say, well, why would it be different? I don't know, but I don't know why it would be the same either. And if we're going to be good scientists, you can't just assume that it's, you know, what you'd prefer it to be. It'd be nice if it were the same in all directions. Well, yeah, it would be nice. It'd be nice if I had $1 billion, but that doesn't make it so, right? I mean, if we're going to be rigorous about this, we need to test it. So how would you test the one-way speed of light to see if it's the same going out as coming back? And you see why I'm doing this, because if the speed of light is much faster when it's moving toward me, there might not be a starlight problem at all, right? Because it might take the light no time at all to get from those galaxies to me, even though it would take a long time for it to go back. It doesn't have to go back, though. It only has to come to Earth to alleviate the distant starlight problem. But wishing for something doesn't make it so. So how would you measure the one-way speed of light? Well, you can't have a mirror now because we're just going to do it in one direction. So now you need another clock. One clock to tell you when to start the trip and another to tell you when the light hits, right? So when this clock strikes noon, I send out the pulse and it goes over here, and this clock records the time when the light pulse strikes. And you're thinking, oh, it'd probably be a second, 1 second maybe, right? Well, I tried this in my office. I don't have a long hallway, but I can scale down the math, so that's okay. I wasn't Common Core trained, so I know how to do math. but I do have the distance between my watch and my phone, and there's a clock on my phone, right? And so when my clock struck noon, I turned on the light pulse, and it went over and hit the phone. And as soon as I saw the phone illuminated, I read the time. 12:05. And I said, it takes light 5 minutes to go from my watch to my phone. No, it's been 5 feet, right? So that means 1 foot per minute. That's how long it takes for light to travel, right? No. Why does that not work? Because obviously these clocks are not synchronized, right? The clock on my phone is 5 minutes fast. I do that so I don't miss staff meetings, okay? This only works if these clocks are synchronized, and they have to be exactly synchronized because we're measuring something that's very fast. Whatever the speed of light is, it's fast, right? So they have to be exactly synchronized. If they're a little bit off, you'll get the wrong answer. You'll get a speed that's either faster than the true speed or slower than the true speed. You say, so no problem, we'll make sure the clocks are synchronized. This turns out to be very challenging. Usually the way clocks are synchronized, or one way that they're synchronized, is by a radio pulse. In fact, my watch will actually do that. It receives a radio pulse from Fort Collins, Colorado, where they got the atomic clock in Boulder, and then a radio transmitter in Fort Collins. It sends out a radio pulse, and my watch receives that every midnight, and it synchronizes itself. Pretty neat. I never have to set it. Pretty neat. But there's a problem, because the radio pulse takes a little bit of time to travel from one clock to the other. Now, radio is fast, but it's not instantaneous. Do you know how fast radio is? It travels at the speed of light. Yeah. Yeah. But that's the very thing I'm trying to measure. And some people have thought, well, if I put the radio transmitter in between the two clocks, that'll solve the problem, right? Because then it doesn't matter that they're both behind a little bit, the radio transmitter, they'll be synchronized at the same time, yes? No, because that assumes that the speed of light and therefore the speed of radio, which is the same in both directions. If it's not, then this one gets set to noon first and that one gets set to noon later. And so they're not synchronized, you see. And so it would beg the question to assume that they're synchronized if using radio transmissions in this way. Well, as one last resort, we'll say, here's what we'll do. We'll synchronize the clocks right next to each other. Now I can see they're synchronized, right? Because there's no distance between them. And then I'll move one of them or both of them to opposite ends of the hallway. Yes? We've got it? No. Because, according to Einstein, motion affects the passage of time. We don't notice this in our everyday lives because the effect is slight, but it's there. And the very fact of moving the clock has caused it to become desynchronized with that other one. Isn't that interesting? And perhaps not all is lost. There is an equation that tells you how much motion affects time. And so we could compensate for it. We could say, okay, based on this equation, it's gained a second or lost a second. We can then make the adjustment. The problem is, in this equation is the speed of light. Yeah. In all cases, you'd have to already know the one-way speed of light in order to synchronize your clocks so that you could then measure the one-way speed of light. Okay, do you see the problem here? Apparently, it's impossible to synchronize clocks separated by distance without knowing the one-way speed of light, and it's impossible to measure the one-way speed of light without synchronized clocks. Isn't that fascinating? And it's counterintuitive. I would not have expected, before, when I began researching these issues, I would not have expected that the Lord built the universe this way, but he did. He did. God doesn't always follow our expectations of the way that things should be done. But this is called the conventionality thesis, the idea that the one-way speed of light is not measurable, and in fact, is a convention. The one-way speed of light is something that we as human beings get to choose, and that tells us then how to synchronize clocks. And whatever choice you make, as long as you're consistent, it works. You can make it the same speed in all directions if you want to, but you don't have to. You can make it different speeds in different directions, as long as the round-trip speed is 186,000 miles per second. Very counterintuitive. I wouldn't think that one-way speeds are conventional, but they are. Conventional means we agree to it and it works, like the number of inches in a foot. Why are there 12 inches in a foot? Somebody decided there were 12 inches in a foot. They defined it that way, and we all agree to it and it works. Or driving on the right side of the road is a convention. We all agree to that, and that works. You go to Australia, they agree to a different convention, and it works for them. That's conventional. And so apparently the one-way speed of light is conventional. I'm going to skip some of this for time's sake. By the way, Albert Einstein realized this and wrote about it. So this is not something that some crazy creationist is making up. This is something that legitimate scientists that are not even creationists would agree if they are knowledgeable of relativity. So I'm going to suggest that the Bible uses what I'm going to call an anisotropic synchrony convention, which is the idea that the speed of light's different in different directions. And when it's moving toward the observer, it's instantaneous. And so it takes no time at all. And that is consistent with what we know about physics. It's not the only option, but it's the option I think the Bible uses because, well, for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the custom that all ancient cultures implicitly would have used. They didn't subtract off light travel time from events. They treated them as if they're instantaneous, which they actually are under ask. So the bottom line is, if the Bible indeed is using the anisotropic synchrony convention, there is no distant starlight problem because we are seeing the universe in real time. That is one legitimate way to define synchronized clocks over a distance. So even today, we're seeing the universe in real time by that convention. Doesn't mean the other convention's wrong. It's just different. It's like, you know, the ark, is it the ark 300 cubits? Noah's ark, is it 300 cubits long or is it 450 feet long? Well, it's both, right? It's a question of which unit you want to use. And I think the Bible's using this anisotropic synchrony convention, and I'll give you one verse that I think confirms this, or at least is suggestive of it. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for signs, seasons, days, and years." We find later it's the sun, the moon, the stars also, right? And it says, "And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. What was so? He made the lights, and they gave light on the earth immediately. Apparently, at creation, when God created the stars, they immediately fulfilled their God-ordained role to give light upon the earth, taking no time at all, which is the anisotropic synchrony convention. Now, there are other possibilities to distant starlight. I don't claim to have the market on it, but I think that's an answer that works. It's one that nobody's been able to refute so far. I've published this in the literature, peer-reviewed literature, and nobody's been able to shoot it down, so I think we have a good answer. And in any case, even if mine turns out to be wrong, we know that God's word is never wrong. We've seen that tonight. We've seen that when the secularists disagree, the Bible has always turned out to be right. We've seen that the glory of the Lord is revealed in Scripture, that the Bible's right when it talks about the basics of astronomy. The Bible's right when it speaks to the age of the universe. The Bible's right when it talks about the uniqueness of the earth. And the Bible is right when it talks about this in starlight, regardless of whether or not my answer turns out to be the right one, that it, we at least have a plausible model. We have some great resources I'd encourage you to get. We have them out back there. Taking Back Astronomy covers just about everything that I talked about this evening and some things I didn't have a chance to go into. It's a fun book. I think you'll really enjoy it. A lot of beautiful pictures in it. In fact, some people have thought it's a children's book because it has all these pictures in it, but my theory is adults like pictures too. So there you go. And you need pictures when you're doing astronomy. You can't do astronomy without pictures. Stargazer's Guide to the Night Sky, if you want to learn how to find the objects that I talked about this evening, or if you just ever wanted to know more about the night sky, what's that bright object over in the west? This book's going to tell you, well, that's Venus, and here's how you find it, and so on. If you've ever wondered what you can see in binoculars, you know, you can see Saturn's rings in binoculars. You just got to know which one's Saturn. And the book will show you how to tell which one's Saturn. So that's a fun resource. The Created Cosmos takes you on a tour of the universe. Lots of DVDs out there. This presentation you can get on DVD. We should have that out there as well. So lots of DVDs. Ultimate Proof of Creation. I didn't get a chance to talk about that this evening, but if you want a bulletproof argument for biblical creation, this is it. This is going to show you how to show that the Christian worldview is the only possibility. Any alternative leads to nonsense, because the fear of the Lord, you see, is the beginning of knowledge. And if you want to know anything about anything, it has to start with their submission to biblical presuppositions. The book's going to show you how to do that and how to debate the way that Jesus did in his earthly ministry. And Jesus was very good at debating in his earthly ministry. Isn't that right? You want to know how he did it? Read the book. Okay. I don't claim to have mastered it, but I've learned how to do it better by seeing how the Bible tells us how to debate, actually. Discerning Truth, how to spot logical fallacies in arguments that evolutionists make. That's useful to know. And you say, well, that's actually remember I mentioned a bifurcation fallacy earlier. It's got just a short chapters on each one of those fallacies, and there's a couple of tests in the back where you can test your fallacy detection skills with an answer key so you can see how you did. Creation Basics, this is one of the ones that all of our SAF scientists put together at ICR, all of our researchers, just everything you've ever wanted to know about creation but were afraid to ask. Well, it's all in that book. Where did the water for the flood come from? Where did it go? Was there an ice age? And if so, when? And how did Noah get all the animals on the ark anyway? And what about dinosaurs? You've heard a bit about that if you were here this morning. But in any case, that's a great resource by all of our scientists. Make sure you're signing up for Axe and Facts magazine. How many of you are already getting Axe and Facts magazine? Okay, that's pretty good. The rest of you need to repent of that sin and sign up on the sign-up sheet out front. And check us out on the web as well, icr.org. If we run out of resources, you can get them on our website too. And so please check that out. And let's close in prayer. So Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this time. We thank you for the magnificent universe that you've created. And we thank you that we live in such a wonderful time that we've been able to see your glory revealed in ways that our forefathers probably could not even have imagined. Lord, I pray that you would help us all to take this information and to share it with our friends so that they can see your glory revealed in the universe, that they might come to know you, Lord, and that they might come to know you in a saving way, Lord. We pray that you would just open up opportunities using even some of the scientific information as a segue into the gospel message, that people might believe in your gospel and that they might be saved. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.